This is Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io. Masters of Dispute Resolution is designed to provide those involved in the mediation process with the views and insights of the most experienced and accomplished mediators in the profession. We'll share the stories of conflict and lessons learned from mediating challenging and intriguing disputes. You'll hear stories about how conflict affected the lives of those involved in the conflict and how resolution of disputes through mediation provided them with the ability to move forward unburdened by an ongoing dispute. Through our discussions, you will gain insight in how to address and overcome difficult issues and achieve more satisfying results in mediation, whether you're a mediator, attorney, or have been or contemplate being involved in mediation. Your host is Len Levy, mediator and arbiter with ADR Services, Inc., a leading alternative dispute resolution provider. Len litigated complex cases for more than 30 years and has been a mediator since 1998, joining ADR Services on its panel of neutrals in 2008. He has been recognized as a super lawyer in alternative dispute resolution beginning in 2014. And now your host, Len Levy.
Thank you, Daryl, and welcome everyone, and thank you for joining us for Season 5 of Masters of Dispute Resolution, a podcast which will add tools to your mediation toolbox. We're brought to you by ADR Services, Inc. and the American Institute of Mediation. In each podcast, you will hear a story about a conflict, the impact the conflict had on the lives of the parties involved, how resolution was reached, and lessons to be taken from that conflict and its resolution. Now, many of the details of the story you're about to hear have been modified to preserve the confidentiality essential to mediation while also conveying the essence of the conflict and its resolution. Today, we are really honored to have Deborah Bogarts. Deborah and I just actually recently became acquainted, notwithstanding the fact that Deborah has a great deal of experience as a mediator and a mandatory settlement conference officer in San Francisco for, well, over 5 years in Marin County, and also a private mediator for over 6 years. Deborah brings a lot to the table as a mediator. She has a background in a wide variety of areas, employment issues, multi-party cases involving wage and hour, sexual harassment, retaliation. I could go on, but I'd rather hear from Deborah. And one of the things that is very important, I think, Deborah has an understanding of what it takes to settle cases. In part, that's from her nearly 25 years of experience managing two insurance defense firms and 7 years as an associate, which gives her an understanding of how claims representatives set reserves, evaluate cases, and negotiate settlements. And she also has 15 years of plaintiff's work overlapping the defense practice and over 6 years, I think, on the plaintiff's side. So her comprehensive perspective on personal injury cases, as well as her deep understanding of mediation process, really makes Deborah a marvelous mediator, along with an absolutely glowing personality, which I think you will hear in this podcast. So, Deborah, welcome to Masters of Dispute Resolution, and we'll get into the story that you are going to tell us today.
Well, thank you, Len. I think that this master's program is fabulous because it gives us a chance to tell war stories like some of us like to do when we were in trial. And you, of course, are a marvelous moderator for that.
So today, the story that you are going to tell is, I'll let you do the introduction on that.
Okay. And it's interesting, this is about a sex abuse mediation. When I was selected to be a mediator for it, I didn't know either counsel. All I knew, it was scheduled for a full day in person in our Oakland offices. And so that intrigued me. And then I do a lot of preparation. So during pre-mediation phone call with plaintiff's counsel, I learned that it had gone to mediation a year earlier and failed. The defense had chosen a male mediator And the only way this plaintiff's counsel agreed to go back to mediation was if they selected a female mediator. And based on my background with sex abuse cases, I was the lucky one. So I learned that the Jane Doe or plaintiff is now a college student, age 19, who had been sexually abused by a trusted family friend when she was between the ages of 6 to 9 in elementary school. Very typical, her mother had met a significantly older man, 65 at the time, at a festival who became the trusted family friend. And as we all know, this trusted family friend is someone that she really had no experience or background with. So here you have a 65-year-old gentleman babysitting a 6-year-old girl and her brother in their home. When he did so, they'd be watching TV on the couch, and he would touch her breasts and genitalia with his hand. And then later he put a blanket over them to cuddle, and he would touch her under the blanket. And then within that 3-year period of time, it became digital penetration. So at age 14, the plaintiff opened up to her mother about the sexual abuse, and she embarked on what will be a lifetime of therapy. She went through the whole constellation of symptoms that can range from bulimia, anorexia, suicidal ideation, isolation, depression, self-harm, insomnia, loss of self-esteem, body dysmorphia, and difficulty with intimacy with her current boyfriend. So she was very angry, and she's a survivor. The defendant, on the other hand, was not an insurance carrier. Unfortunately, there was no insurance money involved. And the defendant is a trust left behind by the deceased pedophile with his adult daughter as executor of the trust. She is now in her 60s, and the daughter looks like, if you've watched TV, baby reindeer, both in terms of her size and these very intense, grotesque facial expressions. She felt that she was entitled to most of the sum of money left behind by the perpetrator because this was her inheritance. She also may have been abused by her father, and she later admitted that to me in mediation. She doesn't have a memory, but she thinks when she was 3 to 4 years old, something happened, which is what led to her parents' divorce. So just to wrap it up, she then becomes as a sole child, taking him to his cancer treatments before he passed, single-handedly having to fly to different states to sell his dilapidated properties or junk cars that were once expensive cars. And so she has to hire lawyers to deal with the probate and assets. So the estate, once worth over $1 million, is now dwindled by legal bills, including the litigation that ensues from mediation one to my mediation two. Mm-hmm. So the last thing to explain for this setup is that her father was arrested for his criminal acts with the victim. He admitted to the inappropriate touching, but not to the digital penetration. His daughter spent a lot of money with a lawyer to get him out on bail. And then, of course, he died before there was a trial. So the victim was extremely angry when I met her because she wanted to see justice done at trial, and she was deprived from seeing him rot in jail. So one last thing, going back to the estate, the daughter felt that she was entitled to her inheritance, which she strongly believed she had earned, but the victim felt that she was entitled to all of this small sum of money because of what she went through. And so, I mean, we both know that had there been insurance, it would have been worth probably very high single or somewhere in the double digits.
So basically, we have a situation in terms of, let me kind of take it from perhaps the least important thing, the money is dwindling, right? And I'm not sure it's the least important thing here because it may be symbolic of something else. But I do have a question in terms of the plaintiff in this case. And that is, when she told her mother at age 14, the mother believed her.
Yes. Yes, the mother believed her, which is really important. And, you know, the mother and the mother's best friend were also present at the mediation. And you could tell Lynn that while she believed her, she also felt an enormous sense of guilt because she had let this man into their home and made him a trusted friend. So it was fraught with, emotions in both rooms.
And was there any indication at all that there might have been other victims that that were out there?
Yes. Part of the reason why plaintiff, the daughter, was reluctant to settle for more at the first mediation is she believed there could be a couple more that victims that would come out of the woodwork.
Okay. So with that, we have a description of how this was affecting the victim, let's say the plaintiff in this case, and the effect on the daughter was, it seems, somewhat different because she didn't remember, but thought she might have been abused.
Correct, correct. Well, the daughter also, there was high emotions running in the defense room because the daughter felt she might have been abused, but really she focused on the fact that for several years she had been the sole caretaker, taking him to doctor's appointments. He had been arrested. So her own father, imagine that, has been arrested, and she's the only one there to care for him. When he dies, she has to take care of these properties that were in other states in a dilapidated condition. So she was actually putting in a lot of elbow grease on her own. And then, the emotions that must be running with her as well, by being the daughter who may not have gotten all of his attention, was pretty strong.
Okay, so you have basically two emotionally very fragile people. At least it seems that way, but they're coming from different places. The daughter seems to be primarily driven by the desire to preserve for her own benefit, and the victim is basically being driven by the fact that she deserves compensation for something that really is difficult to translate. Your life is completely different as someone who's been molested. I've done a number of child molestation cases where the perpetrator was in jail, which might have given the victims some degree of satisfaction. But that satisfaction was not present here, correct?
Absolutely. You nailed it. She didn't receive any solace from the fact that he'd be rotting in jail. And she also, we think of monetary terms, there also is a need to feel heard.
In terms of the available means of being heard, one of the main would be to be able to confront the person who did it.
Well, yeah, so we're going to get into that when we talk about the actual mediation. You guessed it right.
Okay, we are going to talk about the actual mediation, but we're going to take a break first. And joining me today is Deborah Bogarts, who has a fascinating story that we're going to learn a lot from. We'll be back in a moment. This is Len Levy on Masters of Dispute Resolution.
Masters of Dispute Resolution would like to thank ADR Services Incorporated, your partner in resolution, and its founder, Lucy Barron, for supporting this podcast. ADR Services is one of the leading providers of alternative dispute resolution in California. Leveraging technology to drive resolution, ADR Services is committed to dynamism in the face of growing client need and an ever-evolving legal climate. Now operating offices in all major legal markets of California, ADR Services provides unparalleled in-person and remote resolution services through its exclusive panel, comprised of more than 130 of the most distinguished and talented neutrals across the state, capable of handling challenging and complex mediations, arbitration, and other procedures in every field of law. When you seek the services of a neutral and you want results and satisfied clients, contact ADR Services, www.adrservices.com.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and Deborah Bogarts is my guest, who has just relayed the background of a child molestation matter, which Deborah mediated. And now we're going to get into the mediation. I'm going to start with the question, what attitudes did you have to overcome, or what did you have to overcome to move these people toward resolution?
So it was, that's a super interesting question. So in one room, I've got plaintiff, her mother and her mother's best friend, who I didn't know if she would help or hurt the process. And she ended up helping, by the way, she was very supportive. The attorney was interesting. He was very much focused on getting a settlement. He was older, not a trial attorney, I believe. And so his attitude was one thing I had to deal with, because it may have been in conflict at some points with the other part of the room that was more emotionally based. So I needed to give the victim an opportunity. And I'll call her a victim because he had already admitted to what he did largely. So she needed an opportunity to tell her story, to validate what she went through, and to actively listen. I always ask, you know, do you want to tell me the narrative of your story? I don't want to re-traumatize you. And I read the brief if you don't, but she very much wanted that opportunity to speak. If this case was going to settle on that date, she needed to feel like she had been heard. And actually, when she told her story, my eyes welled up with tears. I mean, it's just so hard not to when you're empathetic. And my role was to make her feel safe when she told me the story, which I hope I did. Mm-hmm. She wanted me to know how much she suffered and is continuing to suffer. She's now in college, and I think she wants to become a therapist, which is also a very natural career path. And she wanted the money because she felt that, and rightly so, he stole her life. She didn't really have much of a childhood. You know, she had been suicidal. She had all those symptoms of the anorexia and the bulimia and the depression we've talked about, and no amount of money will ever make her whole. And she has trust issues, and she has that constellation of symptoms. So in one room, highly, highly emotional plaintiff. But then in the defense room, I didn't expect it, right? But it was also highly emotional. It was her criminal defense, her father's criminal defense attorney, herself, and her husband was an attorney, not in that area of law. The pedophile's daughter was angry, and she wanted to vent as well. Her emotions were raw. She had wild mood swings, and she felt like a martyr. She felt like she was caring for her dying father. She's making some assets for the estate and organizing things and getting no credit. Instead, she's just being told she has to give all of it up. So in both rooms, which, of course, were at the opposite ends of the hall, they're filled with emotions and tears. But more importantly, neither side could really afford the BATNA. In this case, your best alternative to negotiated settlement is trial. Why? Because we're dealing with a fixed amount of money that's already dwindled significantly to less than half from a year ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on both sides, the attorneys would be the only ones who would get the money, because litigation would be expensive. Trial, we know, is expensive. And there would be very little money left in the trust. So at the end of the day, both wanted to walk out. And then both were concerned that the other party didn't walk out. So I had to run down and make sure that they didn't walk out. Right. I ended up making a mediator's proposal, because I believe that's a face-saving mechanism on occasion. Mm-hmm. And the defendant rejected it. She wanted to offer 15% less. So it's really interesting. In the plaintiff's room, we were almost at an impasse. Mm-hmm. And I was very frustrated. You know, you put so much time and energy, and you know, for both the parties, they really ought to settle it. I definitely wanted to see this girl get enough money to pay for her therapy, mm-hmm. and so she could live more constructively than she's been able to. And it turns out that the young, I'll call it victim or plaintiff, very much wanted to talk directly with the pedophile's daughter. She had asked to do so a year ago, and the daughter wouldn't let her. And so in her mind, she wanted the daughter, who's an extension of the father in her eyes, to listen to that same constellation of symptoms that I had, you know, told you about earlier. She wanted his daughter to understand that it really is not about the money. It's about lasting trauma. And so I said to her, you know what? I cannot force a party to pay you money, which I tried, mm-hmm. but maybe I can make this happen for you. So went down the hall, talked to the daughter. She actually said yes.
Wow.
So I decided to line it up. I mean, this is a very interesting step. I got agreement from both counsel not to be in the room. They're both men. And for it just to be myself and the two parties. So we chose a large conference room with glass. And I sat in the middle next to them. And all that the daughter had to say was, "I'm really sorry for what my father did to you." And with that, the plaintiff had told me she would have taken the lesser money offered. And that's all I expected to happen, to be honest. Instead, because I didn't rehearse it and I learned, the daughter came in filled with anger and venting at the plaintiff. She says, "I thought my father was having a romantic relationship with your mother, and all he ever talked about was you. It was like you were his daughter. He never talked that way in glowing terms about me." And her face made all these intense contortions, and she got angrier, and her voice was going up. And to my amazement, the plaintiff, the 19-year-old, was able to maintain her composure. She listened, and then at a certain point, when it wasn't going to be productive, I cut it off. We each went, took them to their separate rooms. And I went down, I pulled out the defense counsel and I said, "You are," I told him what happened. By the way, he was shocked. He also thought she was going to give a one-line apology. He was shocked and I said, "Here's my cell phone number. You ping me when you have the mediator's proposal. A yes to that, we'll try it again." And I went back to the plaintiff's room and she said to me, "Because of that vile behavior and conduct, I should get the mediator's proposal." I said, "Hold that thought." And a few seconds, my cell phone pinged. And I said, "You know what? I'm going to say this. This is your fuck you money. You got it."
Wow.
And tears, you know, I had tears. She had tears. There were hugs in the room. And it was, felt really good. It was a really good settlement.
Well, there is a lot that you have, that you have provided us here. And I have a number of questions. It sounds to me like, first of all, before you went into the room, brought them into the room, what ground rules or what did you tell them to expect? Or what did you tell them?
That's a good thought. So the ground rules were, we're going to go in there together. I expect kindness and reciprocity, that we'll listen to one another. We won't be confrontative. That I really thought, said to the defendant, that there would be an apology as to the admitted behavior or criminal conduct by the father. And that's it. And I also told her that the motivation is, the plaintiff very much wants you to just listen to all that she has gone through.
Okay, so going into the room, your expectations were not 100% accurate as to what was going to happen.
Yeah, completely the opposite, huh?
Right. Yes.
None of us, including her own attorney, ever expected her to basically dump on the plaintiff or victim, which is what she did.
Right.
And by the way, she even realized that after she left the room and she got her composure back, she even realized that what she did was absolutely wrong. It's probably why she agreed to pay the extra money that she had rejected. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, I typically do, in the right case, a signature scotch tasting, just my mediations that are in person. So we have some sort of closure together. Mm-hmm. And the plaintiff and her entourage had to get back because they had a long drive. And so the defense stayed. I usually don't do it with the parties, but in this case, they were also intertwined. You know, the husband's an attorney and so forth. We talked. And the daughter told me that she realized that she shouldn't have said what she did. She was just very raw emotions. And that also was motivating her decision not to pay as much money. And so that helped release for her the ability to pay the extra money. In fact, most of the money that was there, she did pay to the plaintiff. And she also explained to me something else I learned, that the mediation a year earlier, the male mediator, just perhaps that person, was, she thought, very gruff with her and very confrontative, because she had to write what the assets were in order to get bail, and you kind of overstate your assets, perhaps.
Right.
It inflated the value of the property and other things under penalty of perjury. And so he came down very, very hard on her. And that also may have led her to feel less and to feel, therefore, less likely to be kind and to give the money to the plaintiff.
Well, what is impressing me is that, among the things impressing me, is the fact that you knew it was going to be emotional. Everybody anticipated it was going to be emotional. But the direction of the emotions, the type of emotion that was driving the impediment, so to speak, was far different than anybody, and perhaps even the parties could have contemplated going into that session.
You're absolutely right. We thought it would be the plaintiff who was unloading all about the suffering that she has experienced since then. By the way, she never did. She never was able to say that. It was all the daughter talking. And interestingly, no one had realized that the daughter needed to have this off her chest, so to speak, with the plaintiff, that she needed to share with her, how she had been feeling. So oftentimes, and particularly in mediation, we may forget that the defendant, in his case, she was, the defendant also has strong emotions and feelings.
And the other thing that I think is very impressive is the fact that you recommended the joint session with the appropriate parties in attendance, and provided that safe place for the two of them to express emotions. They had a shared experience. It's like somewhat like going to different high schools together, but the shared experience of dealing with this molester, but from coming from different directions. Very often, I will make a suggestion, or not that often, but often when I do make a suggestion for a joint session, I always state the reasons that I suggest it. But there are times when, and in California especially, it's a little different on the East Coast, I think, from what I understand. But in California, the concept of a joint session causes a great deal of queasiness in the stomachs of the attorneys representing the parties. It's the fear of everything's going to fall apart because, my God, we can't have these people talking to each other.
I think it's true, but I usually see it that it comes about as a way to break an impasse. In other words, I'm not going to let this potential settlement go. I'm going to try one last ditch effort. And I had another sex abuse case after this where I did another joint session, and it was actually between the pedophile himself, he was the stepfather, and the daughter, who is now a therapist. And she had told me in the room that she never got to hear an apology from him, and it's really bothered her. In his room, he said that he wanted to apologize. And I said, "Well, we'll check the sincerity of your apology by the sincerity of how much you offer," because he also had to offer money out of pocket. And he ended up offering all of the money. And with her permission and with both attorneys present, went into her room. But I had learned from this case I was talking about, and I actually had him practice what he was going to say verbatim, so that when I put him in the room, there were no surprises. And at the very end, when he started to say, "I love you," I could zap him back into his own room. So I think in the right circumstances, it's a good way to break impasse as long as you have the consent of the parties and then, of course, counsel. So it's very delicate. But it has worked when I have done it.
Well, we are going to take a break now, and we are going to talk more about the takeaways from the mediation, from the joint session, from how it was conducted, and perhaps learn a little bit about the difference between settling a case and resolving conflict. I'm Len Levy. I have as my guest Deborah Bogarts, and we'll be back in a moment.
Hi there. We hope you're enjoying another fascinating episode of Masters of Dispute Resolution. Has the show ever made you think about becoming a mediator and doing the work you're hearing these experts doing? Are you thinking about it right now? Imagine a career where you're working to help people in conflict find win-win solutions. The sense of purpose you'll feel can easily be heard in the voices of the guests on this show and its host, expert mediator Len Levy. Or maybe you're a mediator already looking to build your skill set in order to pull off some of the brilliant and out-of-the-box solutions that these guests are talking about. That's where we come in. We're the American Institute of Mediation, and we train mediators of all levels. We're the place you come to learn the basics of mediation or to raise your game in the field. We specialize in mediating commercial and litigated cases, but we teach the skills in such a way that will work in any setting. Our slogan is world-class training for the complete mediator because we feature the world's best mediation trainers and we prepare you for all aspects of being a professional mediator. Find us online at AmericanInstituteOfMediation.com and browse all of our courses that are available for streaming on demand. You can watch our courses at your convenience, at your desk, on a plane, or in bed in your jammies. We'll see you in the mediation world soon.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution, and this is Len Levy, and we're talking with Deborah Bogarts, who has conveyed a fantastic story of child molestation and healing that apparently took place here. So, Deborah, aside from the monetary aspect of it, how important was it that the parties have some sort of a healing process take place?
I think the healing process stunned me in the way it evolved, but it was so necessary because then the trouble was the executor of the estate, the daughter, was unwilling to part with some of her inheritance. And after that healing process was there and she got to see the plaintiff as this, you know, troubled young girl, she was able to part with her money. So, you know, sometimes it's not really about the money because the victim or the plaintiff was willing to take less money, but she just wanted to have that first conversation with her. And she had been waiting a year for it. So it's amazing how if you stop thinking purely about the money and you think of those non-monetary terms, you can get to a resolution, both in their personal lives and in the settlement.
And, you know, one of the things that emotions add to, let's say, to the impediments that we have to overcome as mediators is that we don't often have the opportunity to identify the emotion that is kind of the stopper in the bottle, so to speak, preventing things from pouring out. Could you comment on how the session, how that joint session and the surprise with the molester's daughter talking about another emotion that is somewhat, it seemed, anger at the victim for taking her place as the daughter, it would seem.
I think you unlocked the key there. Mm-hmm. Was I certainly hadn't focused on that before. You know, you go into the defense room and you're really looking for how much money can they part with? Should they part with? Since in this case, they realize they're going to lose at trial. So it's really usually about the money. But I had seen a range of emotions even when I went into the room with the daughter of the molester. And so it really turned out to be the key that I hadn't focused on. The plaintiff and I had talked about the fact that the father had most likely molested his own daughter too. And she even said, you know, if she would just admit to that, I'm able to let go. So we had all these discussions, but it wasn't until she raised it herself that we realized what was going on. So sometimes, you know, this breaking impasse here was really the plaintiff's idea. It was something she had wanted. And then it was very cathartic for both of them in a very intense way. What happened?
And sometimes that the conversations need to be face to face, and that's something that I think in terms of one of the takeaways that we have from this hearing this experience is you have to be open. Everybody has to be open to the possibility that there is an emotional reason that is creating an impasse. And the approach that you took was essentially, let's see what that emotional makeup is that is impeding this impasse. In other words, impeding this settlement. In other words, trying to identify as opposed to identify from hearing the parties as opposed to deciding in advance, oh, this is what must be happening here.
Well, that's true. It's a little nerve-wracking when you put the parties together, especially an emotionally volatile issue, although I didn't see this coming. But I had another case, a little off topic here. It was an employment situation where the sole owner of a kind of a charity, if you will, very small, had to let go her CFO, who she had been very friendly with. And she really couldn't get over the fact that they had been very friendly and now they're not. But I had spent a lot of time with the plaintiff in his room, and I had seen a lot of his anger and realized he's very charming on the surface, but there was perhaps a little bit of sociopathy there. And so with the employer counsel permission, I went in and talked to her and said, you know, I think I see another side to him and I want you to see it because maybe you'll be able to let go. You can afford to pay him more and let's do that so he's out of your life. So it was on Zoom. I brought them both into my so-called office and she got to have this very limited exchange with him where she got to see this other side of him. And that unlocked the key that we went back. I got more money and we got the case settled. So it can be very pivotal.
Right. The thing that sometimes comes up is from an attorney standpoint, I don't know whether this was a contingent fee case. It appears that it would be.
It was.
Okay. So if the attorney substitutes his own interests for that of the client in this case, it can essentially be like squeezing an ice cube too tight, hoping that it's going to somehow grow. It's going to melt. You know, sometimes you have to be able to trust the mediator, trust your client that there's going to be a need for a joint session. I had one of the very early on in my career, I had a case that had nothing to do on the surface with emotions. It had to do with principles that the parties had, the defense, even though it would cost him more money to defend, if he thought he was right, he was going to spend that money, even if it meant that the money would go into his attorney's college fund for his kid, as opposed to his college fund for his kid. And it evolved into they want to talk to each other without the attorneys present. Have you had that situation before? Or was this the first time you had thought to do that?
It was the first time I did it without their attorneys present. I've done it before, as I said, in a select few cases. In employment, which is an emotional area sometimes, and also in sex abuse cases. But the decision not to have the attorneys present was this needed to be more of an intimate experience. And as we started this conversation, the reason I was selected was because I happened to be a female mediator with experience in sex abuse cases. But being the female mediator was primary. And it's super interesting when you talk about what's the difference maybe between male and female mediators. I do believe that we have some natural empathy and compassion and kind of high EQ that is very helpful in this area of the law. So I wanted to be just intimate in the women that were talking. And I don't know we would have had such an honest, candid, all-out conversation otherwise, but it worked. Thank God it worked. And it's interesting, I went back in the plaintiff's room and her attorney was very concerned about there being a settlement and the money and documenting it. And I said, can we get to that in a moment? I just want to give your client a hug. I want to be able to tell her mother and her mother's best friend a little of what happened. Tears were flowing. And so there was the emotional component and then the attorney's need to pin down the monetary part.
I had an employment case where the employer wanted a joint session without attorneys. And the employee's attorney was very concerned about that, became even more concerned because part of that was a take it or leave it that included no money being paid to the plaintiff, which kind of blows out a contingent fee. So there are parties to the case, and there are attorneys who, in my view, should think first about advancing their client's interests. And it's the, you know, the getting to yes, the Fisher and Uri getting to yes idea, that's the role, advancing, you know, reconciling interests. If we're just talking about money, what tools do you have to pry money loose?
That's exactly right. So interestingly, I teach at UC Law SF, formerly Hastings, class on negotiation, and we use that book, Getting to Yes, with the students. Mm-hmm. So I love the principles advanced. And in this case, that we go back to, I don't think I could have pried the money loose from the daughter, even though she knew she'd leave it all. She got into the gladiator stance of saying, I don't care. So we go to trial, and there's nothing left. I'd rather pay it to the attorneys. You get that, right? Yep. But by letting her have her peace and speak, even though we were very worried and concerned over what she chooses to say, that let her release both her emotions and her pocketbook.
And you know something, the crazy takeaway, I think, it seems crazy now, is allowing the defendant to express her emotions satisfied a need that could not have been achieved in trial.
That's exactly right.
So
advantages of a mediation.
Yeah. You know, as we talk, the idea of being able to pivot as a mediator and what you did to do that was really, I think, a key that attorneys should understand. There are times you you should generally, if you've chosen the mediator for a purpose of advancing your client's interests, what mediator has the tools, has the ability, has the background to advance your client's interests? And if both of you, both attorneys have, or all attorneys, however many parties there are, have that ability to want to advance the client's interests by choosing the mediator, the appropriate mediator, that it's an amazing thing that what could have done in this particular case, expressing it in front of a woman, it would appear would be the absolutely right way to go. And the attorneys recognizing that was a very important first step in reaching a resolution, along with a just marvelous job you had as mediator to pivot into, let's try to figure out what's driving the bus here. Okay, so I thank you for for really for conveying this story. Is there anything else that you a takeaway that you want to express?
I think you've expressed it best for me. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And this was a fantastic experience. I want to ask you if people want to reach you, what is the best way?
It would be to Katie Jones Management Team. I work with Jennifer Mendez, and it's 650-746-4048.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you again. I really appreciate your being here, and the conversation was just absolutely enjoyable. Hopefully, we can do it again sometime. Thank you, Daryl Wayne, my engineer and producer. I'm your host, Len Levy, and this is Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io, powered by Infigen Labs, Inc. I hope you will continue to enjoy the stories we bring you. And in the meantime, stay well, keep listening, and remember, peace of mind is enhanced when conflicts are resolved.
If you wish to contact Len Levy, you can reach him through his email at lslevy@adrservices.com, through Len's website, lenlevymediate.com. Telephone him at 818-903-5562, or contact his case manager at ADR Services, 213-683-1600.